clear to, I think it was clear to both of us, to all of us, that this was something that had happened and that probably wouldn't happen again. But what suddenly occurred to me was that the real problem that he was having was not about what had just occurred, but that he really didn't have a capacity to trust. And that is what started me off on writing about this topic. So I make the distinction between having the capacity to trust, which goes all the way back to childhood experiences, or you can build a capacity in the course of adult life, but it's difficult, and the specific responses that we have to people who hurt or betray us. And one thing is for certain. Since it's part of human nature sometimes to let other people down or to be unfaithful or to betray or to disappoint, it must be that our adult task is not to go out looking for someone who will definitely be there for us in every possible way, but to have the resilience to deal with betrayals when they happen without retaliating, and to receive fidelity when it does happen. So this changes our orientation. Instead of saying, I'm looking for someone who will always be faithful and true, we're now saying, as adults, I want to have the kind of psyche that will appreciatively receive all the moments in which someone is faithful and true. And I also want to have the capacity to handle any betrayal that occurs and not have to hurt the other person back. This would be a combination of psychological health and spiritual consciousness. So my proposal is that given the kind of world we're in, our trust has to be provisional based on what the record shows. And even with the best record, anything can happen. So our accent will go on how can I receive and deal, and secondly, how can I be trustworthy no matter what? And I use a little example in the introduction that kind of puts it into perspective. Here it is. We might summarize by saying, as we become more adult in how we live, we do not fear trusting others, but we remain on our toes. We're always on the lookout, but we're not afraid. At the same time, though we can't trust everyone, anyone can trust us because we've chosen to live in integrity. Here's my example. To use a simple example, at the public pool, I can hand my wallet to only the one person I know and trust while I go for a swim. But any one of the 100 people at the pool can trust me to hold his or her wallet. Follow the idea? That kind of summarizes that part of the topic. So, as we become more interested in how we build our own trustworthiness, we become more adept at noticing who is trustworthy and who isn't, and we become more able to deal with any disruptions that may happen. Now, I'm thinking of trust, and this is how I express it in the book, as something like a compass. If you picture a compass with the four directions, put trust in the middle. And this trust can go horizontally, east and west, self and others. So trusting people. North, trust higher power, however you happen to see that. And south, trust reality. Can I trust in all four directions? Would be the same as, what work do I need to do to build trust in those four directions? And I'm trying to show how to do that. So let's take a look at each one of them. To trust others, as we've already said, it will be provisional based on the record. And it is possible when someone hurts you or is unfaithful in some way, although trust issues are much bigger than just infidelity, that you find a way to work through the disruption and regain the trust if possible. This will only be possible if the other person is willing to go that way. And it'll take a lot to get there. And if, by the way, the person who was unfaithful was having an affair with someone, and then it came to an end, only then could you start working on the relationship. That's different from finding out that someone is a sex addict, and it isn't about just that person, but there's a whole fabric of sexual activity that is also very questionable as far as how the relationship can really survive. So you would want to look into that. That would take a 12-step program to work with. Trusting yourself has to do with, can you trust your intuitions? Can you trust your what your body tells you? Can you trust the work that you're doing on yourself? Can you trust your spiritual practice? What is the spiritual practice? To live your life in such a way that you show loving kindness no matter how other people treat you. Trusting in reality has to do with trusting that whatever happens can somehow be a pathway to more wisdom and more love. Not the what I would consider superstition of some of the New Age approach, which is, oh, everything happens for a reason. Oh, everything happens for the best. I'm suspicious of that. I would rather say, everything that happens is an opportunity for some type of growth, and it's up to me to take that opportunity and go with it. And then finally, trust in a higher power would be trust that there's some type of larger presence that holds us, and this could take the form of a personal God, or it could take the form of trusting the universe as continually evolving and carrying us along in its evolutionary work. But not the idea that we can trust the kind of a God who will intervene in such a way as to make everything turn out the way we want it. So that would be an extremely adult move. When you no longer see God as the rescuer. Because if you look at the 23rd Psalm, it doesn't say anything about rescuing. It says, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me." It doesn't say, "I won't have to walk through the valley of the shadow of death because I've got you on my side, and you will prevent me from having to go there." It only says, "You'll be with me as I go through it." It's an extremely mature view. So I see the trust going in those directions, and I'll just read this one paragraph, and then we'll open it up for questions, because I'm more interested in basing what I say on what your concerns are. This is a little quote from the book. "Trust is our best path, but discernment in how we place our trust is crucial. All of us have been lied to, deceived, or let down in some way. Yet we can remain heart-centered while proceeding with caution." Isn't that a great way to live? Heart-centered, but proceed with caution. "And we can develop greater resilience in the face of life's inevitable rejections and disappointments. Only two qualities can get us to that point. First, building inner resources so that our safety and security lie stably within ourselves, rather than I get my safety and security from others. And secondly, an unconditional yes to life as it is, without protest, without blame." That would be the pure acceptance, which of course becomes one of our resources. So, questions about this topic? Because we all have trust issues. And it's good to look into what trust is about. And by the way, the dictionary definition of trust is, helps us. Reliance on perceived reliability. Not promised reliability. The dictionary can't promise you that. So it's, you're relying on someone or something that you believe is reliable. See, when we put that belief in between the reliance and reliability, it becomes very iffy, doesn't it? This is why trust is such a fascinating topic, and why it's something that you can't be secure about. It's very mysterious, because trust means I trust that I'm safe and secure, and yet you can't be safe and secure as long as you're trusting. Because you can't be sure, absolutely sure, that the other person will definitely be there in the way you want him or her to be there. So what are we going to do? Not relate to anybody? Hate people for being like that? No. We're going to say, oh, so that's what it's like. So how shall I proceed so that I can remain heart-centered and be cautious? This is the adult response. Question? Yeah.
You know the story about the frog and the scorpion? The scorpion.
Yes, right.
Well, that story means a lot to me because it changed my ideas about trust. And my idea that I brought with me tonight is that I trust people to be who they are, not necessarily who they say they want to be or who they want me to believe they are. And I'm wondering if that's... whether that's different, the way I stated, is that different from your idea of trust when you say be careful or cautious of whom you trust? And
about
you
the
trust?
Same. Yes. Yeah.
What is the function of trusting?
Some people haven't heard the story.
It's a good story.
The scorpion and the frog.
Oh, did you want to mention?
Well, yeah. Okay. This is a bridge, but the scorpion wants to cross the river, and he can't swim, so he asks the frog to take him, and the frog says, no, you're a scorpion, you'll sting me, I'll die. And the scorpion finally talks him into it, so that they get, when they get to the other side of the river, the scorpion stings the frog. And the frog says, why'd you do that? You promised you wouldn't. But I'm a scorpion.
That's what we do.
So now that scorpion knew himself, but he deliberately fooled the frog. But so what is the function to us of trusting other people? What does that do for us or them?
It creates connection, and this is what we're mainly looking for. And this connection is based on building more and more trust, which happens as people come through more and more for you and don't purposely hurt you. So the work for an adult is not to try to find somebody who's like that in a knock 'em dead, definitely, infallibly clear way, but to take it a day at a time. Trustworthy today, so everything is working. And when trust isn't happening, that's when you speak up. Now, one of our problems is that sometimes we notice someone's not trustworthy, but we can't let go because we become kind of addicted to that person. And so we put up with a lot of pain, painful relationship, for instance, because we can't let go of what isn't working. So part of the work of learning to trust yourself is, oh, I'm not going to do that to myself. That's how you get to trust yourself, when you notice that you don't keep yourself in painful situations.
Don't you think it's possible, though, you're a trustworthy person, that you will recognize this in another person? I'm not necessarily seeking this out and making this your standard, but there will be a sense of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And you can trust
yes.
in that way.
Absolutely. Most people have that intuition, but the intuition gets shut off on some enchanted evening. And the
not necessarily if that's what the attraction was in the first place.
Well, I was thinking of this song, My Foolish Heart. So I'm just going to quote one little section of it.
Not going to sing it? I'm just teasing you.
What a company.
There is a line between love and fascination that's hard to see on an evening such as this. For they both give the very same sensation when you are lost in the magic of a kiss.
Yes. Magic of the what?
Kiss.
Can everybody get it?
Yeah.
So they are different, but in that heady moment in which everything is so enchanted and you're kind of falling head over heels, then the line disappears. And since they both feel the same way, in other words, both bring up adrenaline, you can no longer tell the difference. So another way of trusting ourselves would be being very, very careful about anything like that. Being able to say, wait a minute, this is just a movie. Let's try this out in the light of day. Yeah?
Well, when you were telling the story about the couple, and you said, well, then if the, I think it was the woman that was unfaithful, the way you were telling it, it sounded like.
Yeah.
And then she agreed that she was going to go back. But I also think that sometimes what happened in the beginning of the trust was a trust that wasn't necessarily wanted to be made in the first place. I'm not advocating for monogamy or polyamory or anything, but I mean, it could be that there needs to be a new agreement made,
mm-hmm.
not just let's return to we're monogamous and we're going to be faithful to each other, because usually there's something else that triggers that. The person feels trapped or limited or wants to rebel, you know, and so I think it's important that we realize that we can't, there usually is something that we have to grow and make a new agreement about, not just return to the previous.
Yes, it isn't going back to the way it was.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, I agree. Yes, it's starting over. Yes?
Yeah, another proposed answer to Kyle's question about the purpose of trust came to me was that it builds resilience and gives me this opportunity to look at my attachments. And on the line of your comment, regardless of whether you're in a polyamorous or monogamous relationship, if you're on a serious spiritual path, you can go as fast as you want, you know, depending on how willing you are to confront those.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's that.
I want to go back a minute to what you brought up also. Because one of the statements that's usually made when someone is unfaithful is, quote, there must have been something missing in the relationship, which is why you went elsewhere. I'm not falling for that fully. I mean, that could happen. So I break this down, the work of the partner who broke trust, the work of the partner who was betrayed, and the work of both together. So now I'm in the section on the work of the one who was unfaithful. Pay special attention, I'm speaking to that person, pay special attention to what was missing in yourself rather than in her or the relationship only. We've heard it said that infidelity refers to a lack in the partner. We then look for and come upon someone who can give us what the partner lacks. The standard view. However, what is missing also refers to something awry in the inner life of the one having the affair. The fact that any affair has an addictive, compulsive quality is a clue that we are trying to fill a need inside that may be a bottomless pit, an indicator that it is an unmet need from childhood. Thus, the issue for us when we are unfaithful is not only what is missing in the relationship, but what is overly needed by us. If you need it that much, it's not about your partner. It's going all the way back to what was missing in childhood. Because we learn to trust by the safety and security given to us by our parents. So if that was limited, damaged, or even absent, then the capacity to trust has also been damaged. And since your needs were not fulfilled, they become a bottomless pit. And you're out there looking for fulfillment anywhere you can find it. And I go on, generally when a need was met in a healthy way in early life, now we have the capacity to be satisfied with a moderate amount of that need fulfillment ever after. That's the true happily ever after. That you can be satisfied with the reasonable amount that humans give. Not the amount that you see on the screen in the movie. However, our unmet needs have an altogether different fate. Unmet needs have a different fate. They become insatiable. This leads to an addictive clinging to an obsession with anyone who seems to offer just the brand of fulfillment we always wanted. The excitement and sense of appreciation we feel toward the one who makes this happen makes us believe that we are in love. But in authentic love, repose follows union, and insatiability is a signal that we are mistaking immediate fulfillment for full-on love. If it were real love, it wouldn't lead to insatiability. The work is to mourn the past with all its unmet needs and to acknowledge with an unconditional yes just how inadequate childhood was. And we do this without blame or hate toward our parents. We begin to free ourselves from the past. Our search for someone who can give us all we missed becomes an openness to the many ways that this might happen. For example, through friends, career, self-esteem, and the sense of being held by a higher power. Then our validation comes from within, and we learn to hold our need without going outside our relationship and without putting too much pressure on our partner to get it met. We notice a natural toning down of our need, something we can't discipline ourselves into. It happens as a consequence of this work, and without it, we are sitting ducks for the next person who comes along and winks at us in just that special way. We've all been there. Other questions? Yeah.
I find myself thinking about Maslow's peak emotional experience. He introduced peak emotional experience as an actual physiological need.
Yeah.
That we all have, and it becomes a very provocative need. I see it as a need for drama. And so there might be an unconscious drive that moves us to create this drama of betrayal, and just to see how it's going to work out, and hopefully it'll bring you to a higher understanding, a different space. It's there's all kinds of unconscious things
at work.
At mm-hmm. work, you know?
Good. Well, thank you for reminding us of that.
And it's healthy. The need for,
yes.
for peak emotion. And if you're not finding that in somewhere, you're going to look
elsewhere.
In all the wrong places.
Right.
How do you feel about the theories where some books I've read that to trust, you need to be completely open, both partners, with everything, you know, from how you feel and what you do.
The honesty idea.
Complete honesty.
Yes.
The radical.
The way I look at it is never to lie, but that one, we do have a right to a sector of our psyche that belongs just to us, and that we don't have to share absolutely everything, and that you certainly don't want to share things that would only hurt someone else rather than give them important information that they need so the relationship can survive. So I don't like the black and white style of the, you know, total honesty about everything. I mean, we're always honest, but we're in the sense that we're not lying, but we don't always self-disclose. I make that distinction. So I'm always honest, but I'm not always going to disclose everything. Because some belongs just to me, and some can only be placed into the hands of those who know how to handle it, such as a therapist or, you know, somebody who has the skill to help you with it, especially things that happened in childhood. Does this make sense to everybody?
Yeah. Sure. I was just reminded of the Greek mythology with the muses, and how the muses were so respected as far as being an inspiration.
Yes.
That that they felt that without the muse, I mean, they included muses in every part of their life, and they were admired, feeling that without the muse, we didn't have that sense of excitement that we were talking about, and without that sense of excitement, we lose creativity.
Yes.
So it was just an interesting side.
But that kind of excitement is an arc of creativity that's different from the excitement of adrenaline on some enchanted evening. That isn't an arc of creativity. That's a descent into, and hence called falling in love. It's a descent into what could be an illusion that, oh, at last I found someone who will fulfill everything that was left unfulfilled before. As soon as we think that about anyone, we know we've entered the realm of illusion rather than reality, because there is no one like that.
Well, that's again about knowing yourself. What you said before about how important it is that you have to go back to learn what your own personal needs are.
Mm-hmm.
In order to understand.
And that's a hard one.
Any further.
Right. Even to know what we need is a difficult one. I mean, I've talked about the 5 A's that we needed in childhood. We needed to have someone pay attention to us, know what our needs were. We needed to have someone accept us as we are, appreciate us, that is, value us, show affection in physical but not sexual ways, and allow us to move on out when the time comes. On the first day of school, you have to be encouraged to go. You can't be, oh, don't leave me. Well, I can't imagine saying that. Anyway,
can you name all five of those?
Get the idea. It's attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, shown physically, and allowing.
Thank you.
Oh, wait, let me get somebody that hasn't there. Yeah.
How do you differentiate between trust and expectations? And how do the two interact?
As you become more grounded in reality, you let go of the expectations, because they're one-sided, they're unilateral. It's I expect you to be this way. So wherever you see an expectation in your relationship, you want to call yourself on it and ask for an agreement. Instead of saying, I expect you to be there for me when I'm sad, you say, can we make an agreement that when you see me sad, you'll stop what you're doing wherever possible and spend time with me? And of course, not even agreements can be fully trusted, because a person may not keep that agreement. But at least you've put it out there and you've established it as one of the ground rules of the relationship. Yeah.
I just, on that note, I feel like if certain expectations are not met, then it starts to break trust. For instance, let's say it's a time thing. Let's say you expect that you're going to have someone there saying they're going to be here at a certain time. And if each time they keep breaking that, you assume it's an expectation because they agree. You say, you'll be here. Yes, I'll be here.
You think you can trust it.
So then what happens is it feels like the trust keeps eroding. And I think that really digs in. Becomes a bigger problem, obviously. So it's like,
I agree. Well, in that instance, you're saying this is somebody who doesn't keep the agreement. So when someone doesn't keep an agreement, you would be assertive enough to speak up. We have an agreement. What happened? Where was the breakdown? And you're hoping for an apology and change for the future. If it's not happening, if it's one disappointment after another, then there's work to be done. And, you know, that's where therapy might be helpful. It's hard to do some of this work on your own. Somebody else? Yeah, way in the back.
Yeah, from our discussion, I'm reminded of a word in the subtitle of the book that's going to be read from a couple weeks from now here, and the word's innocence. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, what is the relationship between appropriate trust and innocence or naivete or gullibility? And again, things that might seem similar for the, you know, the innocent child, but as an adult, some people keep getting wounded in the same way, maybe, because of their trust. So it's just, how do you see those two connected?
So you'd have to be at the point in life when, well, maybe the best way to express it is this way. Every valuable virtue would be in the middle, and I'll give an example. And then there's a spectrum. On one end is deficiency, and on the other end is excess. So let's take a simple example. In the middle, you have the virtue of courage. Not enough, cowardice. Too much, foolhardiness. The two ends are both going to get you into trouble. The middle path is the one that offers you an inner resource. I can call upon my courage. Trust in the middle. When it comes to deficiency, that would be the person who is constricted, can't trust anybody. And the excess is the naivete. That would be the person who is just so open that he or she trusts anybody in this innocent way, and that person will attract predators. The one on this end won't attract anybody. He doesn't want to attract anybody. The one on this end will attract the predators.
They're what?
Predators, people who try to take advantage of you. So we would want to watch out for that. So being naive would not be, that's not really trusting.
That's asking other people to do your work for you.
Yes. And only gets you into trouble ultimately. Yes.
Is there any overarching reason why someone who is very naive and continues to attract people who are predators or abusive relationships, what it keeps them from actually moving forward and learning from those experiences?
Okay, well, let's look. I have a specific section on there on that. It's called Why Do We Put Up With Pain? When there's a breakdown of trust, we wonder why sometimes the betrayed or abused partner tolerates unhappiness and hurt for quite a while rather than taking expeditious action to make a change. It's a mystery about us humans that we will sometimes act in self-defeating ways. So what are some of the possible reasons that we would stay in something that has shown itself over and over again not to be a really working relationship, not to be one that gives you safety and security, which is what we as adults are looking for, although we find it mainly in ourselves. We want to be with somebody that we feel safe with and secure with. And I have my list of why we put up with pain. And the very first one has to be, connection of any kind may be more important than happiness. As long as I've got somebody, that's more important than whether I'll be happy. And I'm not going to read all of these, but I'll just read a couple of them. The devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. Nothing better will come along. Some of us were brought up, this is for the Catholics in the group, some of us were brought up to believe that the purpose of life is to endure pain, not to be happy. Then putting up with the predicaments of ongoing abuse can seem like fulfilling our life purpose. In fact, our religion may promise a reward in the hereafter if we endure now. And this confirms our despondency about deserving happiness. Here's one. We engage in wishful thinking. Things will change for the better. Such false hope is a form of despair, since we've given up on our own power and insight. Real hope is based on actual evidence of progress.
Can you read the first one again?
Connection of any kind may be more important than happiness.
There's a great quote from the Declaration of Independence that says, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed.
Absolutely. I have that quote in here. You're going to love my last one. Moving out of our unpleasant lifestyle means we have chosen to move on to the next chapter of life. We might unconsciously be afraid that thereby we are one era closer to our death. So our remaining on the stage of agony now is our way of avoiding the final curtain.
Really?
And then I ask the question, are we such subtle escapists? Are we that subtle? Could we be actually doing that? I don't know, but I put it in there. I thought maybe somebody in the one of the readers might one of the readers might say, that's it. Let me get somebody who hasn't. Yeah.
I was going to ask you if any of these were results of working with your clients
and personal life, yes. Definitely.
I have actually said those things.
Oh yeah, I've heard every one of these. Or felt them. Good. Other? Okay. So I have two more questions.
Wondering about, there's a great book written on the web called The General Theory of Love.
Yes. I use that as part of my research.
And I'm thinking about one of the things they suggest in there is whatever we receive in early childhood is what we are hardwired to expect, and that it's very difficult to spark romantically to something that is not familiar, i.e. like family.
Yeah. Yes.
And if connection and abuse or that big disappointment was always paired, it's very difficult to move on.
Yes, because the pairing comes in automatically. The painful circumstances may be familiar, F-A-M-I-L, in both senses. They resemble our family background. We saw our parents being like this. And we feel accustomed to them. They have become so routine that we fail to notice that they're unacceptable. There's a natural link between familiarity and safety. Unless we break that connection, we are at the mercy of it. The real safety is in our daring to move on, not in our standing still, waiting for a push. Imagine that being the real safety. The real safety is in daring to go. Reminds me of a poem by Emily Dickinson in which she uses the example in which she compares the birds, that there are some birds, she lived in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and there are some birds who stay there for the winter, and it's a very harsh winter, especially where she lived, which is out in the western part. That's colder because it's not on the water. And then there are other birds, as you know, that migrate and go to warmer climes. So she says, the southern custom of the bird, that ere the frosts are due, accepts a better latitude. We are the birds that stay. The shiverers round farmers' doors, for whose reluctant crumb we stipulate, till pitying snows persuade our feathers home. So the orioles flew to Santa Barbara, and those little sparrows, they're begging those stingy Yankee farmers to throw out one little crumb. We are the birds that stay. So if that's who we are, we want to fly south wherever possible. And of course it's, you know, it's daring. It's not easy. Especially when it's our whole background. You know, our whole background has been not pushing us out, but helping us stay put. So do we have one last question? Somebody who hasn't asked? Okay.
Well, I'm just thinking that there's this realm of the mystery of love that maybe is a little different than the psychological tools that we're talking about, and the relationship between Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera mm-hmm. is an example. I mean, certainly one could say that both of them could have left each other at numerous times, but there's an aspect, I also think, to love that, you know, so complicated who we are that sometimes you could stay because you just love that person so much. Now you could continue to take care of yourself and change the way you're relating to them. But I feel like we can't discount the greatness and the complication of relationships that are rich love affairs that aren't, you know, necessarily only about our psychological makeup or just taking care of ourselves, but actually doing this dance that no one else necessarily can know.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I think there is a mystery to all this. Most of us are in awe of this mystery, and some of us saw this in our parents. I mean, they may not have seemed like they were very happy a lot of the time, but we felt that they really did love each other. And maybe they were trustworthy toward each other. That means a lot. Maybe I could end with this beautiful poem by Amy Lowell. She's a Boston poet, lived during the turn of the last century. And she had a female lover, and she wrote this poem to her on their 10th anniversary. It's called A Decade. And it shows this mysterious power of being together that feels just right. And it's really a beautiful description of a truly healthy relationship. When first you came, you were red wine and honey, and the taste of you burnt my mouth with its sweetness. Now you are the morning bread, smooth and pleasant. I hardly taste you at all, but I know your savor, and I am completely nourished. So thank you all, and I'll stay up here if you want me to sign one of your books.
thank you so much. That was really wonderful. And thank you so much for coming out. We have a few, just a couple of announcements very briefly. Number one, we have a donation bowl there on the counter to help support this space and our speakers. And I want to point out that in addition to this book that we've been talking about tonight, we also have a plethora of Dave's other books, and they are a wide range of topics and interests as well in this and some other areas. So please check those out as you leave. And finally, I want to thank you all for coming out and joining us in this conversation tonight. And he's already promised, and I trust he is daring enough to sign his name to some of these books, here or there, as you wish. Thanks again. Oh, and by the way, the recorder did, in fact, work. Our trustworthy Daniel was able to repair it. We probably only missed a